Hello, gaming intelligentsia. Before we start today's podcast, here is a message from our sponsor. The Agamenex podcast is made possible with the support from our sponsors at Pragmatic Solutions, leaders in intelligent platform technology. The Pragmatic Solutions player account management platform is an incredibly powerful technology stack for today's gaming business. Their modern, modular platform provides all the core services to power your business, and their SaaS licensing model allows you to reduce cost and accelerate your strategic goals. Enterprise technology with decades of operational know-how at scale built in. Upgrade your business to the Pragmatic Solutions PAM platform. Visit www.pragmatic.solutions to arrange a platform demo. And now, here is today's podcast.
Future trends, deep insights, industry leaders. This is the iGaming Next podcast with your host, Pierre Lind.
3, 2, 1. Jesper Kärbrink, tjena, hur är läget?
Hej Pierre, ja, men det är bra tack. Det är jättebra, själv då?
Det är jättebra här också. Det känns jättekonstigt att prata svenska. So maybe we should switch over to English. What do you say?
Yeah, of course we should. We have an international audience, and this actually reminds me when I started at Mr. Green, we had this. I think we were 34 nationalities all in all at Mr. Green, and I mean they were all kind of languages. It's the coolest thing ever. And then at some meeting, I addressed everyone and told them that just so everyone knows, we have two official languages at Mr. Green, and I said English. Then I held it there for a while, and everyone expected me to say Swedish, and they became a bit nervous and so forth. And then I said, and broken English, and I present the later. So yeah, we continue with broken English here. I think that works.
Yes. Yeah, that's the best accent of English, the broken Swedish English accent.
Exactly. And so far, I think most of the people has understood us, actually.
I would hope so.
Yeah, but coming to that, I have to give you some credit here, because it's this is not our natural language, and we are a bit limited in how we express ourselves. And just as another story here, my colleague Ben McDonough listened to me doing a presentation in Swedish for it was recorded in TV or something like that. So I sent it over to him just as a fun thing, and he said, "Wow, that's a total different you." So apparently, when you actually, even he didn't understand what I said. He heard on my tonality.
Was it in a good way and a bad way?
No, I think it was in a good way.
Yeah, otherwise it's...
Yeah. So, So kudos to you to do all this podcast in the non-natural language, yeah. So to speak.
But you know what, Jesper? I mean, I've lived now in Malta for the last 10 years, and it becomes after a while, like, actually, you start processing thoughts differently. After a while, after living in outside of your native country for a while. So, for example, if I am very stressed and I want to take notes, sometimes it depends on which state I am mentally. So I sometimes my thoughts are in English now, like more and more as the time goes on. My natural language I'm actually much stronger in English. And I remember, actually, I'll tell you a funny story. One of the first times I met you was actually when you were at Mr. Green. And we were pitching Agami Idol to you in the very inception of Agami Idol. And I had to do that pitch in Swedish. And and I hate doing pitches in Swedish. I really resent it, because you learn how to do certain phrases and how you formulate the pitch and how you you do it so many times, you know, so it becomes second hand. But then to do it in Swedish for the first time was actually like, I was nerve-wracked before that meeting, actually, and I wasn't able to like formulate that pitch well at all to you. That was the first time we met.
But I think we actually joined you there, so I think you didn't fail totally, at least. No. But
yeah, it was a total disaster.
But I agree with you. Actually, writing a PowerPoint presentation is much easier to do in English, because that's the language you're so used to use and do it in. But try to write a book in English, that would be, or whatever. And you see that also when you read an English article in a newspaper, sometimes even even if, I mean, every book I read is in English. I read all my literature is in English, etc. But when I read one of these more deeper articles in the magazines or newspapers, I struggle with some of the words. I have to kind of read them once or twice. And so there's a layer still where that at least I don't really master yet. But doing a PowerPoint presentation, true. I agree with you. Yes, I'd rather do it in English as well.
Yeah, it's true actually. There was someone who said that people who can speak in many languages, you learn how to think in concepts rather than just speaking the words. So sometimes that means also sometimes that struggle with how to formulate certain sentences because you understand the concept, but not exactly always the how it should be phrased in one or the other languages. It's quite interesting. So let's say that it's our superpower.
That's our superpower, exactly.
The three languages we know, Swedish, English, and broken English. So Jesper, I want to ask you the same question as I asked Robin Reed in the last podcast which was the fact that, you know, when we came to New Year's Eve now a couple of weeks back, people were celebrating, you know, they were celebrating, screw 2020, it's over. The past is the past, 2021, here we come, you know, and then like 5 days into 2021, Western democracy is falling apart, things are going not so well as expected. But in either case, I also, Robin, you know, what's your New Year's resolutions now for 2021? How are you looking forward to this year in general?
But I'm an optimistic guy, and I always start a new year being very optimistic, and yeah, this year started, of course, that was one of the most crazy things I have seen. But honestly, we should all have seen it coming because that guy is the Trump. I mean, he has behaved as the idiot he probably is. So we shouldn't be that surprised. Unfortunately, he took it all the way out. And that, for me, that kind of only shows how stupid he is as well. I mean, he killed his own legacy. Whatever legacy he had at that point, he could have saved some of it by walking out with some honor and focusing on the vaccine program, et cetera, et cetera. But now he just killed it. But that's one guy. I still think that, it also showed that the US democracy actually works because it stood back in basically all its full power. So I think this year has started good. We have winter in Sweden. That's a good thing as well. And 2020 will go to memory as a very difficult year for a lot of reasons, and a very strange year as well because it's. Normally when you had really really bad years, they affect everyone, especially when they affect the economy and the financial, or perhaps not everyone, but the majority of the people. But this time it has been divided. We are an industry that actually has been doing good during these years. And then we have other industries that's totally catastrophic, like hotels and restaurants and airlines and travel agencies, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of a divided experience. Yes, underneath you have the pandemic and the COVID disease, of course. And for those who has been really affected that one, that's like awful. At the same time, that the other 95% has not even been touched by it, or whatever the number is, and then some people has had devastated experiences from a financial point of view, while others actually has grown their financial assets, etc., etc. So it's a strange year. It will go to history as not only a bad year but also a strange year in that sense.
That's definitely true. It's a paradigm shifting year in some ways. So with technologies moving forward, some organizations
exactly they will come out. Yeah. They will come out some really good stuff. I mean, if you look at the health sector, the public health sector has probably the digitalization in this sector has jumped 5-10 years, leapfrogged in 1 year. And you see this in the way we can meet now, and you see this in education, et cetera, et cetera. So no, there's a lot of positive things coming out of this, but in essence, we have had a pandemic, and that's a negative thing, and it also had a really negative effect on the economy in general. But still, there are unusually many that still has done all right economically this year. So it's going to be strange. Oh, sorry, 2020. So 2021, I don't really give any New Year resolutions. I mean, be my best and do whatever I can to be a good father and a good husband and a good colleague and friend, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I try to do. Just promising one thing this year. Why should I just go with the flow? And, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. I like it. There shouldn't be any goals. It should just be a lifestyle, right?
Yes, exactly.
That's how it should be. Be a good person. Let's set that as a consistent New Year's resolution every year.
Yes, have that as a resolution to yourself, and always try to be the good guy. Of course, even the good guys become assholes sometimes from time to time. That's like you can't help it or you can't stop it or whatever. Yeah. But if you try to do more good than bad, I think that's a very good step forward.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that as well.
Yeah, and then that's also important. If we're going to be a bit philosophical here, it's not really me to decide if I'm a good guy or not. There's too many people that really think they are the good guy. It's for my surrounding to decide whether I'm a good guy or not. The people I spend time with and live with and work with, those are the ones that decide if I'm a good guy or not. That's the important part.
Yeah, that's a great perspective. And before we leave the philosophical point here, I think that's a good way of seeing it, because I don't think anyone sees themselves or very few people see themselves as a bad person. People tend to tell themselves a story why the world is against them, for example.
Back to Trump again. He thinks he's the smartest guy and the best guy on earth. I mean, basically, he's an asshole. But. You can't be the judge of yourself. That's kind of, you will always be too kind to yourself.
Good life advice in general to keep in mind, I think. Yes, right. So I'm just going back to a little bit what you said beforehand now when we spoke about 2020, Jesper. You talked about, you know, the rollout of the vaccine and how this will and how far the medical industry has come now in 2020 with the advancements in vaccine technology and so forth, and how certain industries have been immune to the pandemic in general, as iGaming has been one of them. Now, there was a quite interesting thing that happened back in November when the results came out from the clinical trials. That basically the news broke that the vaccine was very effective, more effective perhaps than what many people thought, and certainly what the investor thought. And upon this news, the stock market went haywire. I mean, certain industries shot through the roof, other industries tanked, and iGaming being one of them, interestingly enough, where I remember on the day of the news, the share price of Evolution dropped by 15% upon the news of the efficiency of the vaccine, because now investors thought that people are not going to gamble anymore. Can you talk a little bit about your thoughts on that? Do you think that the iGaming industry will be affected negatively? Or, and also just a follow-up question on that as well, the people who have been introduced to our ecosystem during this pandemic, will they stay or will they go back to land-based casino, for example, from where they were used to playing?
No, that's a super interesting question. It proves one thing to start with, and that's that the stock market is wrong every day, but it's always long in the long run, right in the long run. That's the beauty with the stock market. But they are every day they are wrong. I mean, there's nothing in that said that Evolution should drop 15% that day. It's like ridiculous, and so every day they are wrong, but still long term they are right. And that was, of course, an overreaction on both sides. Some stocks went up like crazy, and some stocks went down. But that's the stock market as it is. It's a flock mentality, and people are scared, and then they see opportunities and they're jumping. So it has its own dynamic that, it's for me, it's very, very difficult to understand sometimes. If you look at this from a longer perspective, this has been fantastic for the digital industries. I still have an interest in sending flowers since my years as the CEO of Euroflorist. We at that point we send like a million flowers a year. They have more than triple that by now. So there's so many more flowers sent last year, of course, because it's the digital service. So to order it, then you can't visit your relatives and your fathers and mothers and so forth. So you send flowers. Uber shot through the roof. You never see so many people driving food back and forth in the cities, et cetera, et cetera. And the same with gaming. Yes, of course, the initial impact is, if we compare, I would assume at least, when we compare 2021 Q2 to 2020 Q2, we might see a decrease. But if we compare it to 19, it will still be a massive uptake because we have more customers. We have more material to retain, so to speak. And we have new customers coming in there. Will they leave? No, I don't think so. Will they play as much as they did when they were totally alone, had nothing to do, sitting in the sofas all days? No, perhaps not. But if we compare to before the pandemic, it will still be a lift. And this goes for gaming. This goes for sending flowers. This goes for Uber Eats, et cetera, et cetera. There's so many things that, yes, if you go back to normal, but it will most likely go back to normal on a higher level. So this has been beneficial for a lot of digital industries. So it, once again, it's a matter of what you compare with. I think doing the comparison between 20 and 21, yeah, it could look a bit weak, but we should look back at 2019, because that's more, 2020 is an abnormality in itself, in so many ways. I think we should more compare to 19, where everything was normal again. Or perhaps we have to do this in 2022. We don't really know where 2021 lands either. I mean, we have the vaccine, we have mutations, etc., etc. So let's see. Let's do this podcast in December again and see where we actually are or where we ended up.
Exactly. That's a good thing, because there's still a lot of uncertainty, right? And we as event organizers know that more than anyone, I think, that planning any form of event with certainty in this year is not the way forward, let's say. We need to proceed with cautions, just like you mentioned. I think that's also what experts have been saying, that the vaccine is just a one step in the process to get back to normality, but it's not going to be the only step.
No, honestly, I think we are back to normality when we consider COVID-19 being a normal thing. Yeah. And like we do with the flu, and this might be this will be a stronger variant of the flu. It will have a higher death rate, etc., etc. But at some point, this will be normalized with the help of vaccine and with the help of us normalizing it as we tend to do with everything. There's so many dangers out there that we have normalized, and one of them is the climate, as yeah. Of course, but also other things. So yes, you're right. The vaccine is only one step in normalizing this. Our mindset is another. The financial financial effort done now is another. If you look at this from a larger perspective, so yeah. There are many steps to take. So I think 2021 will still be a year influenced by the pandemic to some extent.
Absolutely. That is, there's no shadow of a doubt in that. I would like to add to this as well that, the interesting thing now is as we go into the future and if we defeat COVID-19, let's say, you'll see this once every couple of years that there is a epidemic usually, and then let's say once in a decade or so there'll be a pandemic. The swine flu was the recent one in like 2009 or something.
Yeah, it was. I think so.
And not many people remember this, but the swine flu was a proper pandemic that basically circulated through the world. And it went a little bit unnoticed in the news and so forth. But I think that what the COVID-19 situation have done now, it has set a precedent for future pandemics. Yeah. So, if we roll back the tape 1 year and a little bit longer, and the COVID-19 was circulating mainly in China, it spread to Europe, and the epicenter in Europe was Italy. And during the time when the cases exploded in Italy, everyone was very nervous. Here in Malta, people were freaking out that this thing was happening in Italy. But there wasn't any at that time to close the borders, for example, because that has never happened in our lifetime. You know what I mean? Like, this is not something that existed within our realm of thought, right? So can you close the borders to the entire world? you know, and we got the answer to that during this pandemic. So when the next pandemic possibly, the threshold to close the borders and the input restrictions will be a lot lower than it was this time. Do you know what I mean? So we have to be, the world has to be aware and prepared for that, right? So, you know, from an investment point of view, you know, when you look into the future, not only do you need to look for recession-proof investments, you need to look for pandemic-proof investment as well, because this is now something that is on top of mind in people. You know, they are scared of this happening again. And I think the we will, as a society, will close down and try to defeat a potential pandemic much, much earlier next time.
Yeah, I agree. At the same time, we should remember that the collective memory is one of the shortest memories you can find. That's why we have ups and downs in the economy, and we tend to forget things. I mean, very few people remembered how what they did when swine flu came and how they reacted, etc., etc. We want to forget these kind of things. So unless this next pandemic comes in like 5, 6, 10 years, well, yeah, then we might remember it. But if it comes in 20, 25 years, we will be back on square one again.
And
we should remember that this was not only a pandemic. I think this was the first time ever we had an infodemic at the same time. And that has also, we have to remember that has created a behavior that earlier pandemics didn't. I think I'm not saying that this is wrong, but I think we panicked a bit more than we did with swine flu, because we got this up in our eyes or in our foreheads every day, every morning. And we saw all these sick people, and we read about all the death rates, et cetera, et cetera. And that scares you. Information that comes hundering down and down, it scares you over time. And for good reasons as well. So I'm not saying it was a bad thing, but this is the first time when we had such a huge information flow around the pandemic. I mean, basically, we had an infodemic. And that has to be taken into account as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely true. And that's the thing. That's what I think as well, that this will happen the next time as well. Because obviously the media is working out of getting your attention, right? And what better way to get attention when there is just a little warning sign of an epidemic happening? This is going to be scaled up the same way it was done this time as well. So I think the world is not to be aware of that.
But you're right. But I think back to gaming again. So yes. the effect on the gaming will be relative. The vaccine comes. Yeah, we will go back to normal, but we will be on a higher normal. We will be on a new normal. We will have more players. We will have a new breed of players. I spoken to some operators. They say that they clearly see how these players are coming from more social gaming and more entertainment reasons, and not only from the closed casinos, but rather from entertainment areas, so to speak. They want to test out new things, and that's fantastic for us, because the broader our audience will be, the more stigmatized our industry will be, and those goes hand in hand. So actually, reaching out to more new customers that are not gamblers at first hand, but entertainers at first hand, that will do good for the industry, not only from a financial perspective, but definitely from a stigmatization and branding perspective.
Yeah, and that's something we talked about last time in the last podcast that we did together as well. The stigmatization of the industry and how to solve that problem. You know, we talked about solve player responsibility, and you solve basically the stigmatization of the industry as well. But is that just one part of it, or like you're saying, this entertainment drive that we hear left, right, and center at the moment? I mean, can you give your thoughts on that, Jesper?
How
can we get closer?
I would like to start a bit earlier, I would actually start with responsible gaming. As long as we do that as a way to reduce stigmatization, we will always be stigmatized. But when we start to see responsible gaming as part of the business, and we some people see that this is our corporate social responsibility to offer responsible gaming routes and so forth. And in my book, that's wrong. That's part of our business. We have to start to see responsible gaming as part of the business plan and the business concept we have. When we do that, that's the first step to get away from the stigmatization. And then, of course, if we also can make it to become the entertainment we think it is, or what we want it to be, that will help a lot. And once again, 7% of the population, 6 to 7% of the population in Sweden, I think it is, plays slots. The rest thinks that's a useless entertainment or a time of value or spend time. It's like, so and when you have that small portion of the population, it's very difficult to defend it when people are attacking it. There's so many attacking it. But if we could get up like 30-40% of the population actually being on the online casinos and entertaining themselves, the stigmatization would be gone. Mm-hmm. But to get there, we first start to need to get responsible gaming as part of our business plans, and not something we have to do, but something we want to do to increase our business. So I think these two go hand in hand, but entertainment, absolutely. And we will come there, because soon we have all the old bricks and mortar casino players are entering into the online world. When that happens, we have to broaden the customer base. And also we have new generations coming up, and they don't see a slot as the fastest way to entertain. They see other means, and they are more used to playing social games and skill games, etc., etc.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. And as you are mentioning, the traditional land-based casino players are in pretty rapid pace moving on to online. There was EGBA, they released a report just the other week detailing that the total online revenue from the total European gambling revenue rose from 24.8% in 2019 to 34.7%, I believe. So from 25 to 35%, basically, in 2021. Now they expect this to decline a little bit in 2021 as the casinos are now open again.
Yeah, they expect the growth rate to decline, and I'm not sure perhaps the numbers. But have you started? What happens?
They expect 2021 to be 29.5%.
Okay, so they even think that the rate will okay, fair enough.
Will actually go down.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I totally agree with them. Depends on how they define an online player, of course. But if you have been in the casino and then you moved online, yes, you will absolutely go back to play to the casino, but you will still continue playing online. So what happens here is they're going to be dual players. And as we talked about before, just because I can, in a couple of months, hopefully I can be back to the restaurants in Stockholm again, it doesn't mean that I stop ordering Uber foods. I've been not doing it as often as before, but before the pandemic, honestly, I never did it, because we have restaurants all around the corner here. But during the pandemic, yes, we started to do it, of course. And then going back again when the pandemic is over, yes, we're going to go back to restaurants, but we will also order food from Uber. So it's the same here. Yes, I'm a casino player. I love to be in the casinos. But then I realize how fun it is to sit in front of the TV and watch a game and bet some on Liverpool. And I will continue doing that. So I think, once again, this has had an impact on the online transformation curve, and that continues underneath. We have a 10% growth in the industry, and the majority of those players are coming from offline to online. That will continue for a long, long time.
Yeah, and I think that what you are saying is the key here, which is like the tech fluency is rapidly increasing, right? So we have been forced to use these services in a way. We have been forced to learn these services as a society in some way. So yes, many people who never ordered food through Uber Eats before have done it now, and they've learned how to do it, and they've created a new habit.
Yeah.
We created a new habit that is now easier in some ways, right? But
And I have seen this in so many in other industries as well. I mean, I was in the yellow page industry for a couple of years when it really took off, and we went from basically 10% online to 80%. I think it's like 99% online today. Yeah. Sending flowers. When I started at Euroflorist, I think we had 30% of the volume came from online. Today it's 70-80%, something like that, if the curve has continued. So the curve it won't stop, and then it accelerates, yes, because of this, and then it deaccelerates a bit when things are back to normal. But this curve will continue, absolutely. There's a transformation from offline to online in gambling.
Yeah, and I think like if we break it down by now, we speak about the EU as a whole, the 34.7%. But if we break it down by country by country, it can really highlight where the potential is for the online gaming industry to grow, even in a saturated market like Europe. Because look at the differences. Okay, so I wrote this up just to remember it. So like, look at the differences between Sweden and Italy in tech fluency, because that tells a good story, I think, where more than like 60% almost of the total gambling revenue in Sweden comes from online in 2020. Okay, and 40% comes from lotteries and the brick and mortar casinos and so forth. And then compare that to Italy, which has the lowest part from online. Revenue comes only from like 10.5%, and the rest is from lotteries and brick and mortar casinos and so forth. And that really tells the story what potential it is if you look at these less developed countries, let's say, when it comes to tech fluency, at least, where the future lies in the future growth in those markets.
You're absolutely right. Italy has a huge growth factor because they will end up on the 60% where we are in Sweden today. Sweden will end up in the 80-85%. Yes. That's a matter of fact, because this is a digital product and I consume it. I can buy the scratch card. The majority of this, of the offline sales in Sweden, is there. Yeah, there's some casinos and some video lottery terminals, etc., etc. But the majority are lottery tickets, and more people are starting to buy those on their mobile phones. And so I would say that the end game in Sweden, 85%, and that is the same in Italy. And more interesting, so it's the same in the US. And this is where we have the huge...
That's where we're talking.
Yeah, exactly. Not only because they're most likely opening up more and more states faster than before as an effect of the pandemic, but it's also be a massive movement from bricks and mortar into the online business. And this is, of course, also why we see all the big players today acquiring and trying to acquire online businesses like the Caesars and the William Hill deal, the MGM and twice right now. So yeah, I mean it all fits together. You can see this puzzle so clearly. And in due time, 85% of all the gambling in US will be online as well. First of all, it's gonna be regulated, and then it's gonna be online.
So, yeah. And it's so interesting because you can predict exactly how this curve will transpire just by looking at the examples like Sweden that became tech fluent so early. And you can also, there's something we talked about before in the podcast too, you can also predict how the regulatory landscape will follow that curve as well. So look at Sweden. Sweden wasn't the first country to be regulated, obviously. No. You can still see how the influence in society grew by the years of the online casinos until it went to the point where, like a tipping point, where regulation became inevitable in Sweden, because it was so in your face kind of thing that government has to do something. And that's also something you can predict for other markets. Let's say the US, for example, which is a good example. It's like we are just in the infancy of online gambling in the US. And we can predict now that the market will follow the same type of trends as it's done in Sweden, and eventually it will be so impactful into society that the regulation need to change to adapt to that. For example,
absolutely, I agree to 100%. The only thing you can't really predict is the size of the market, because that's not the curve. You can't copy the relative.
Why not?
If you use the GDP as the factor, the gaming per capita is higher in Sweden than it is in certain other markets. And that comes from a culture background where in Sweden it has been okay to gamble since the 1700s, and then when the state took control of it. And we have the Nordic Museum. It's a huge museum in Sweden. It's actually funded by lottery money. A lot of the sport and the industry, penning lottery, A lot of the sports and the industries are financed or have been historically financed by gambling. So it's a legacy of and it's also very low stigmatization when it comes to gambling in general. And this is quite interesting because in Sweden there is a level of 65-70% of people are gambling in the sense that they pay for something and there's a chance of winning something back. And then you ask your friends, are you gambling? And say, no, I don't gamble. But, no, but you bought a scratch ticket, 3 slotten. Yeah, but that's not gambling.
That's not gambling.
Exactly. That's not gambling, no. So I think I would say that it's even higher than the 65-70%.
I mean, look at Bingo Lotto.
Exactly, Bingo Lotto. Everyone bought one.
Every single person.
Yeah, exactly. And then when they call, say, no, I'm not gambling. No, I'm just buying Bingo Lotto. So, and you don't have this. And then you have other countries where it has been. You have not had this really state-owned, driven big pools, etc. So you can't take Sweden or any other like UK. You can't take those as an example, saying, okay, X your population is this, your tech savvy is this, and when it comes to this, it's going to be this. No, but you can see the trend and the curve will be the same everywhere. So whatever gambling you have, it will move from online to offline, and whatever gambling you have that is unregulated, like in the US has a I would assume a pretty large black market for sportsbook that will now move into the regulated area, and then it will become a part of a growing industry.
Yeah, and let's stay on that topic a little bit because it's super interesting, and I'm trying to also understand this a bit better. I mean, Jesper, you used to be the CEO of Mr. Green, obviously an operator. Mm-hmm. And I look at, for example, the differences in the approach that certain operators are taking to the US. Let's compare, for example, the approach of Kindred versus Betsson. Mm. Okay, so Kindred is going all in on the US as an operator. They are investing heavily. They are building a strong team over there. They are acquiring licenses, and we talked to Manu Stan, who is the head of US. Really interesting. He talked about the strategy there, and they want to create a foothold now in the US market to be able to establish themselves and earn money later, obviously. And then compare that to Betsson, which I also talked to Pontus Lindvall, the CEO of Betsson AB, and he has a much more cautious approach to the US. He is aware that for Betsson as an operator to establish themselves in the US, they have to invest a massive amount of money for a long time. It can potentially hurt their EBITDA. Shareholders not so happy and so forth. How do you explain that to the investors that you are spending more in marketing than your entire revenue, at, like what DraftKings are doing, for example? What is your opinion? What should an operator of that size do at the moment? It's a very difficult decision, isn't it?
Like, yes, it is, and I think you have
it's to. It's a gamble.
It's a gamble, absolutely.
And we are in the gambling industry.
Yes, we are. So, but either Henrik or Pontus is doing the right gambling here. Let's see that. But if we back off a bit and take it from a higher perspective, it's a huge market. It will, as we talked about before, it will follow the growth trend and it will be the biggest gambling market in the world. But it's also geographically a big market, and it's I don't know whatever. So let's say the end game is that, like, 37, 38 states legislate sportsbook and casino, and that's like 38 countries, because as it looks right now, yeah, it's the same language, etc. But from the licensing process I have been involved with in when it comes to the states that are open now, there is a new license in every state. Yes, you can reuse a lot of it, etc. But and then market wise, it's different to sell this, and you will have different competition in Texas most likely, and than what you will have in New York, etc. So it's a huge bet. And you have to ask yourself, who are the most who are the best suited to win that market?
Exactly.
For me, it's the gigantic brick and mortars. They've been there for ages. They know it, and they have the cash flow for it. They have the cash flow for it.
And they have and the brand equity as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And now they have woken up and realized that. And this is the pandemic. The pandemic kind of shortened that that time, it got them to understand this faster, because suddenly, bang, revenues were gone. We have to do something else. And of course, I would put my money on the MGMs, the Caesars, the Lynn, et cetera, the big ones that have been there before. And interesting enough, those are the guys that earlier has kind of lobbied against a federal gaming regulations. Those are the guys that they have invested massive amount of money in stopping online gambling. Now they are starting and like Hard Rock, and I should mention them in that line as well. And then they're not only starting, they're also acquiring. We're talking about the $9-10 billion potential bid here. And of course that should be paid back at some point. So I think we will see a huge shift there, especially if these guys step in. And then being a Betsson and or a Kindred, you are a pretty small guy. I love them both. I totally respect them, and I like the ways that I can see benefits of both ways they are doing it. And if you look at this once again, Kindred has not failed with many things they've decided to do, so we should give them that credit. But at the same time, they're stepping into a huge market where they're going to be some heavy guys fighting for that market. On the other hand, if they do 3 or 4 states, that's like 3 or 4 more new markets in Europe or elsewhere in the world. And exactly. That could be super enough for them. Or they do 5 or 6 states. That's a fantastic achievement. So I'm not saying that what they are doing is wrong. Absolutely not. But to conquer the entire United States of America, I think you need to be one of the big ones, whether that's a Lynn or a Hard Rock or a Caesars or an MJ. I don't know. And it's also interesting to see how different strategies these 4 had from the beginning, but now all of them had from the beginning, but now it seems that this is an acquisition strategy. They are acquiring their way back into it. They're using their very strong financial positions and the liquidity.
Yeah. But also, you know, an organization like Kindred are putting themselves in a position where they can be acquired as well. You know, if they manage to somewhat get a foothold in the US, why wouldn't a land-based casino in the US want to acquire the competence that lies within Kindred?
We saw this exactly what happened with William Hill. Yes, I don't know if that's a strategy. That's a very difficult strategy to have. We're doing this to be acquired, especially if you are stock listed. But exactly. You're absolutely right. It could be the end. Not their planned end game, but it could be the end game for any companies on the stock exchange succeeding in the US. And once again, I think William Hill and Ulrich prove that to be true, because they really, that's what happened with them. I'm not sure that was their strategy or their plan, but that's where they ended up.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a little bit the point, right? As a listed company, you're always up for sale, so to say, by per definition, right? And it's
look at Mr. Green. We were not on the stock exchange anymore. So yeah, absolutely, you're always viable.
Yeah,
the price
exactly.
Right, and the shareholders, you should remember that when it comes to shareholders on the stock exchange, for the majority basically on every company, there's no history from the owners. They just I think the average time of owning a stock these days are down to minutes, of course a lot based to all the computers buying and selling and so forth, but yeah, so by default, if the price is right, they sell, period.
Yeah exactly. So I think maybe it's not a conscious strategy of, let's say, Kindred that they want to sell necessarily, but I think that potentially they are setting themselves up to be acquired.
Sure. But you could say that for anything. If you become really strong in Asia, that would be a target for someone wanting to target the Asian markets. You always set up whatever you do. You set up for someone to acquire you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the reason I'm pushing for this, Jesper, I want your opinion on this, because I made a bet the other month, which basically said that if bets on Leo Vegas or Kinder get acquired by a US land-based operator within the next 2 years, or if they don't get acquired, I have to eat my sock.
Okay, that's an interesting bet. I think I actually think you don't have to eat your sock. With the pace we see right now and the valuations that the US stock market are attributing to the European companies, I think you don't have to salt it or pepper it, keep it on your foot. So no, it's super interesting to see, and I understand why the market. Mm. Once again, the stock market is always wrong, but always right in the long run. So are the prices they are paying the correct ones? Yes, I think so this time, because the market over there. We are talking the sportsbook market.
Yeah.
My view is that the casino market will open up as well in more states than what we see today. It's not even a handful. And when that happens. I don't have the ratios, but we talk about the 3-4 times larger market than the sportsbook, or perhaps even more. So, and that is a huge market. You're probably right. Within 2 years, one of those are most likely sold.
That makes me feel a little bit better. Thank you. but it's quite interesting that going back to Kindred strategy in general, and it's good to point out here as well that Kindred strategy isn't to conquer the entire US. They Manu pointed out, just like you pointed out, that we are talking about 50 individual states, and we have to look at them as 50 independent markets. That's what he said as well. And their strategy is to kind of enter 2 markets per year, something like that, okay. 1 or 2 per year. They choose their states very carefully.
And that is a solid, as I see it from being an outside observer, that's a solid Kindred strategy. As I said before, they seldom fail on the strategies. They are one of the most remarkable companies in the industry. They are just progressing. And we saw their latest report. It was a reversed profit warning. That happened, exactly the same thing happened when I started at Mr. Green just a couple of months after, and everyone was asking me, what have they done? We must do the same thing. But the thing is, they are not doing one thing. They are doing a million of things all the time, and they are just improving. And when you get all these cogs to hit in the same way, these things start to happen. So it's, I know, I'm really impressed by how they are, or how Henrik and his team is running that company. It's mm-hmm. quite fascinating to see.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, because now it is a real turning point in the industry when this huge market is opening up, and at the same time, regulatory challenges in Europe for the traditional markets that these kind of tier 2 operators have been operating in, Sweden, UK, Germany, and all of a sudden, as an operator, you really have to you really have to pick your strategy wisely right now to set yourself up for the next couple of years.
You have, and you really need to expand. And the challenge for this industry will come in 5, 6, 7, 8 years time when all the markets are there are new territories to conquer. There are new, all the routes are taken, all the maps are written, etc., etc. So if you want to be a famous explorer, you have to do some really crazy stuff. And we're not there yet. There are still a lot of markets that will open up, and there are still a lot of markets that is not really explored yet, so forth. But I would say within 10 years, this industry is going to look totally different. And I think we will see on a larger scale, this will not, it not be a monopoly, but an oligopoly in Swedish, or whatever that is in English.
Oligopoly.
Yeah, something like that. I think people
know what it means. Speaking about broken English.
Exactly, that was really broken English. So I think we will see, perhaps not a handful, but a limited number of really big players taking over the gambling world. And that makes sense, because we all want to have big pools. We all want to have high liquidity, whatever we play, poker or bingo or doing the lotto coupon or whatever. So it's nothing unnatural in that. It's basically where the industry is coming from. And I think it will reverse back to that. And those will be gigantic companies, because at this, already today, money-wise, we are one of the largest, or perhaps the largest, entertainment industry. And if we also can add the entertainment value to this and get in a more broader population, not spending as much as the top players, but still getting the masses in here, this can be a fantastic industry to be in. And once again, it's a digital product, so the impact on everything is quite simple.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that as well. And I think, just like we talked about now, is that the winners, so to say, in 10 years, when this shift have happened, you'll see the decisions that are being made now, I think, are going to set up these companies for either being one of the winners or one of the losers. So if I were, for the investors at the moment, should really pay attention to where the operators particularly are positioning themselves right now, to set themselves up for success. And the ones that are, too stuck in certain traditional markets without a clear strategy for how to become a true global company, they might be the ones who are struggling, even if they are big today, let's say. Yeah.
No, but we had this discussion back at Mr. Green, me and Per Norman, that we were, on a good day, we were one of the smallest of the largest. Depending who we spoke to, we were one of the smallest or largest, and we were one of the biggest or the smallest. And we were in this no man's land that was extremely difficult. We saw this to be happening. We saw this, so we realized that we need to be bigger. Either we become bigger by ourselves by starting acquiring companies, or we get bigger by actually being part of a larger context. And at that time, we also saw that others saw this with us, and then was when the M&A talks started. But for us, that was part of it. It wasn't part of a strategy, but it was part of the future. Either we get acquired or we acquire, because we have to be bigger. And this is what we see now. And if you're on the wrong side of that line, future could be quite tough.
Yeah.
If you're the right side of that line, I mean, yeah.
Sky is the limit.
Yeah, it could be, because it's a high margin business, but it's still it's also volume based business. It scale fast when you get across certain levels. So no, it's interesting. It's really interesting, and especially from the investor side. And I'm really thrilled about this MGM and Tain bid. It's like MGM has declared, not saying it, but they declared, we have to buy something. We want to buy something, and now they put it. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that ends up and what the price is.
They don't have much leverage in that negotiation, that's for sure.
Unless they do a smart double back and go to someone else, whatever that would be Bet365 or whatever. I don't know, but no. Otherwise, they really show their hand very early into that one.
But
it's understandable, because they have to go digital. They can't.
And quickly.
If they stay bricks and mortar, they will slowly. That's the start of a slow fading away, basically, over 2-3 years time, but over 10-15 years time. And being such a large company, you have to have a planning horizon of at least the 15-20 years to come. Because you do big investments, et cetera, so you're building hotels, you're building resorts, and so forth. So they have to know what they're doing, and all of these big ones need to add, in my opinion, they need to add a very stable online business. And it's too late to grow it. It will take too long time. Yeah.
The disruption of the land-based casino industry is staring them in the face now. Finally, I think we in the gaming industry have known this for a long time, but like you mentioned earlier, the traditional casinos in the US have really fought against this. And I think, one example of this is Sheldon Adelson, who passed away now, the founder and owner of The Sands with the Venetian and Palazzo in Vegas, which is my favorite hotel when I go to Vegas. Always Palazzo, never would change for anything.
He has been pouring in millions.
Yes, a biggest donor of the Republican Party.
Exactly, of stopping the federal gaming of course, him passing away, we could probably change that. We don't know how the company or the family will continue this, but I think as soon as they start buying these casinos and once again they will reverse that strategy. They will be more open to it, because they will see that having a unified, if they would have a federal wire act that actually allowed gambling, that then this business would, it would suit them so well because they could roll it out in every state from Nevada or whatever. I don't know how that would work. But nevertheless, even if it's just state by state by state, it's a fantastic business model.
Yeah. Continuing on that line, you know, like we saw now as well, Shay Segev, he stepped down from Entain now, from out of the blue, as it seemed like. You know, he went to obviously a quite lucrative deal, most likely, with Dazn, the streaming platform. But this happened in the middle of this process of MGM trying to bid for Entain, and you know, it begs the question, you know, what if you are Shay and you know that there's an imminent takeover happening by MGM, you probably would be looking for options for yourself. You know, so the question is, do you think that there's an imminent takeover happening?
No. No. We have to separate these things. Okay. MGM is, as we said, should be really, really interested in acquiring something. I mean that's clear, and they've set their targets, and so that they want to do that. They even put an offer there, and that offer is rejected or passed back or whatever you call it, and then Shay leaving. Yeah, it's in the same time, but it necessarily doesn't have nothing to do with this. That's just speculation. Sorry.
It's fun to speculate.
It's fun to speculate, but the thing is, when it comes to things like that, there's only one person really knowing the reason for this, and this is Shay. And yes. Whatever we say, it's most likely wrong, or we can do it like 10 guesses and one is right. So I'm not sure that it has anything to do with it at all. He'd been there for 5 years. He was the CEO for half a year. Yeah, that
he, exactly.
You think he should be there a bit longer, etc., etc. But we don't know. It could be whatever. He found his dream gig. They offered him a shareholding that he couldn't resist. There's something around the corner. His family wanted to. And there's so many reasons for this one. But the fact is that MGM is looking at Entain. That's given. But let's speculate. If I was in that position, I would have waited whether they bought it or not to see what happened. If I want, and as a CEO, you can put yourself in a pretty good position there because you are the one running the show. So you don't leave beforehand, especially before it's not decided. Unless you vested in that it should be and it didn't happen, but you don't know that either yet because it's not a definite yes or no. So I think, your speculation is just pure speculation. He has his reasons for it. I would be surprised if they have anything to do with MGM, honestly.
I smell that there's a little bet happening here, actually, Jesper. Can we say 10 euro then, within 2 months that they have agreed to, or not agreed, but let's say that there's a new bid coming.
We can't bet that because we're on the same side. Yes, it will come.
Okay. But it was a good try.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure that was the reason why she left. Okay. I don't think so. There's so many other reasons, and it's so difficult to speculate.
But it's
fun to speculate, yes.
I tried to hustle my way to 10 euro there, but you were quick with your thought, unfortunately, but it was a good try. But you know, let's speculate a bit more, because obviously Shay going to Dazn, which is a streaming platform focusing on boxing primarily, but I think they also want to expand to other sports as well. Mm-hmm. Now that begs a little bit the question, if you are Dazn, and if you have the rights to all these massive sports organizations to stream them live, you have a massive database, a lot of people in your platform consistently, and then you bring on board a gaming CEO. Mm-hmm. You know, speculating onwards here now, wouldn't it make total sense for a company like Dazn to bring on board like sports betting opportunities within their streaming platform? Now talk about disruption. I mean,
yes, no. I love it. That's a brilliant question, Pierre. And I would say this is not only for Dazn. That this could be for any streaming services.
Any streaming platform.
Yes. Yeah, or streaming platform, exactly. And what I see being a bit intrigued here is, if we start a bit off that track, is that they are co-CEOs. Like,
Cozios, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, cozio. That's quite nice. Then you have to have a really cozy relationship if you're gonna do a cozio job.
That's such a Swedish thing.
No, yeah, exactly. That's a Swedish thing. We could do it.
We take positions together.
Exactly. But what happened if I don't agree with you? Who is the? There can only be one making the final call. Yeah.
Because everyone knows that the best restaurants have two chefs. Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I'm gonna talk a bit. You're gonna pepper a bit. No. What you're doing. So you're absolutely right. But sorry, I couldn't resist that one. It's a bit strange. But never mind that. But what they are doing here is super. For me, it's super interesting. That's. I mean, look at this one. I'm a Formula One fan. I watch all the races. I love the drama of it. Even the boring races, I like that. But imagine if I could sit there and not via my, but on the TV and do the in-app bets and there's a very very interesting startup in Sweden. They are doing on the fly odds changes in live events for fast pacing sports like Formula One. We can take that as an example. So basically, as an overlay to TV, you can put the odds on a sticker above Ricardo, and the odds there for him to win is like 255 in the beginning, and then it changes during the race. You can see it. So when he slips in the corner, it goes down to or up to 285, and then he kind of has an opportunity or take over and do a takeover, and it goes down to 220, and that's the thing. You can the increased entertainment level of that, even if you don't bet, is amazing, because then you can follow the race from another perspective. You say, they think he's gonna win. I don't think so. Yeah, oh, look at that. The odds is going down. And here comes Lewis, and he got a flat tire. His odds went from 105 up to 12. But I think he can overtake them back again, et cetera, et cetera. And so but if they add sports betting, I'm not saying they will. You're right. It's the right way to speculation. Yeah, because Jay is coming in there and he has this background. But if they do, that would be an amazing product, and absolutely that would be a disruptor. And then MGM have to buy them instead, or also.
Yeah, also, yeah, exactly. Because then you have ESPN. You know, in Sweden we have C-more, for example, and these other things.
Exactly. But I think the ones that has the biggest clutter is the rights owner, like the Formula One. They control it from start to end. You have the perhaps you have NASCAR and these organizations, and it especially goes with sport where there's a lot of shifts happening. We Swedes, cross-country skiing, that would be fantastic to see how the odds is changing, where they're going up and down in the positions, etc. Yeah. So, but I think yes, streaming services, but it could also be the rights owner that will take this on board.
Because now we're talking about like a shift in consumer behavior and a consumer acquisition from just like traditional affiliate marketing, play at this casino, you get a bonus or whatnot. And now we're talking about like you acquire customers who are not necessarily signing up for sports booking, for sports betting, but they are presented with the option of betting on sports.
Yeah. Exactly. You are so spot on that point here, because what happens here is that I am enjoying the Formula One race as a Formula One fan, or I'm interested. I like the sport. And on top of that, I can place a bet. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. I do that. Yeah, I do it once and I do it twice. And next time I don't do it because the race is there's no thrill in it, etc., etc. So they are, in the sense, acquiring customer without going through affiliates, big marketing campaigns, etc., etc. We are already there as a customer or as a viewer, and then you can easily turn into a customer. Yes. So basically, they are their own affiliations. That's what it is. I don't know the numbers, but we're talking about hundreds of thousands, whatever, watching the Formula One every weekend, or perhaps millions. And suddenly you have a couple of 10,000 customers there betting. You don't have to have them. That's not your core business, but it's a nice side business to have. And we all know that when you don't have to have them, it's easier to get them. because then you can have a bit of a more relaxed relation to them. You're not so dependent on them. You don't come out as eager. You don't come out as desperate. You just come out as, wow, I'm there. I'm there to help you. If you want to bet 10 euros on this race, do it, but you don't have to. And yeah, that's a totally new, that would be a paradigm shift in gambling. But paradigm. People are very pushing and very aggressive, like almost exactly to the level of being desperate sometimes.
Yes.
So that's if that happens, then I understand. Yeah. Then your speculation about him leaving because of MGM is totally wrong. He left to something super interesting, super cool.
Yeah, he left. So yeah, that's a good point. I'm proving myself wrong here.
Exactly. You did. And you tried to bet me on it as well. I think you underestimate me today, Pierre.
Yeah. I like that. I'm underestimating you. I shall not make that mistake again, Jesper.
No, that's totally okay. That's totally okay.
Yeah. But yeah, it's such an interesting thing because when you see this, you know, at least for me, I haven't thought about this possibility before as a streaming service. But then, you know, when you connect these two dots, it just makes so much sense.
Yeah.
The cross-selling opportunity of a lifetime we were talking about here, you know, and it reminds me a little bit of, I mean, from within an example from within the gaming industry, when traditional poker sites started to cross-sell casino within the poker client. Mm-hmm. By offering these like side games, so when you were waiting for the next hand, you had the opportunity to play blackjack, for example, and how that cross-sold the people over to casino, which is much more profitable, obviously, than the rake from the poker hands and stuff like that. And now we're talking about a similar thing here, but on a much, much larger scale, right? Where removing the friction of like most people aren't so, it's not in the top of mind to sign up at betson.com to play sportsbook, because then you really have to be a fan of sports betting to take that big step, deposit, understanding. So now we're talking about within the platform, as you're streaming, removing all possible friction. The streaming platform already have your credit card details, so you can deposit super easy, no friction whatsoever.
No, it's fantastic. And you don't even have to deposit. You can basically pay per bet. And so forth. So they have everything. Is it? Mm. We will probably see this coming. We should. It also, as I said before, it also increases the entertainment level. Because even if I'm not betting, seeing the odds there would intrigue me. And we should also remember it's in the same feed. Whether I'm sitting in front of my TV, I connected my TV to the Wi-Fi or the internet, or I'm using my computer or my looking at my mobile, it's the same feed. Today, when I bet, I have my TV watching the game here, and then I have my phone doing the bet. This will be the same feed. It's an overlay. It's just a click away. And of course, if these guys are smart, they integrate it so I can sit there with my phone. I don't even use my remote control. I use my phone to place the bet, but I do it on the screen where I'm consuming the entertainment. And most of us are still consuming the sports entertainment on the big screens because it gets a much, much better experience, a user experience or entertainment experience rather than the small screen. And if you can add that layer on top of that big screen, you have a disruptive product per se. Yeah.
Absolutely, by definition, it's a hand in glove, you know, and you know this. Way,
so if Shay and his partner hasn't really thought about this one, he should call you and you just spin it up in a PowerPoint for them and tell them this is what you should do.
Right. This is we take 1%. That's
yeah,
it,
yeah. So. Business development by Pierre. That's good.
Exactly. To give credit for it, because now it sounded like the idea is coming from me. This was actually something that Robin Eric Reed mentioned to me. So I don't want to make it sound like I am like the mastermind of this or something, or that I'm coming up with this.
Absolutely. I mean, Robin is a smart guy, so we could assume that something like that came.
That was a given, yes.
Exactly.
But it's such an interesting question because, you know, we talk sometimes about like disruption of an industry. Well, what can disrupt the industry? It's always a healthy conversation to have, you know, and, you know, if you were at a traditional land-based casino 30 years ago or 20 years ago, then the question to that would be online. But it's sometimes not so easy to see the forest for the woods when you're in it, you know.
And what we're talking about here, if we took it from a more philosophical and general point of view, it's adding a layer of entertainment on top of an already existing feed.
And removing friction.
Yes, and this could be the same for this is basically what I would say. This is what Evolution is doing in live casino. They are adding a layer of entertainment on top of classic casino games to a large extent. And so we see this already, and they have kind of proven that this is the way to go. And I think we will see it for the slots. We will also see it for the arcade games that we are working with Green Jade. But we will also see it in the sports book. And this is what the discussion we have had here is, or Robin's idea is a disruptive idea. But you need to own the content. You need to own the streaming platform at least, and preferred with the content or the rights. But this is also, I mean, rights holders are always looking for new ways to find business. So for them, this would be fantastic. And the streaming platform also needs to find ways to monetize on their viewers, et cetera, et cetera.
Of course. So you know, looking forward, let's say like we move a couple of years. Let's say that we are right here, you know, and this is the direction that the streaming platforms will take, not only Dazn, but others. And in a couple of years, you'll have a couple of streaming platforms that are basically covering the rights of all popular sports and series within that sports, all the different football leagues and all these things. And then all of a sudden you have this market where you can sport bet within a couple of streaming platforms, so that will cover all your needs, let's say. So if you are like Bet365 today, for example, and you know that this technology is, or that you know that the industry is moving this way, you should be a little bit scared, I think.
Or you should see the opportunities of doing it the exactly the same yourself. You have the cash flow, you have the players, you have the...
Own streaming platform.
Exactly, start your own streaming platform, buy some content.
Because that's a company, that's an idea, business idea that transcends the iGaming industry, you know, like if Bet365 were start their own Dazn, you know, that would be bigger, that would be a bigger product than the entire organization, so to say.
No. And they can do it. They have everything, and what they don't have, they can acquire, or they can recruit, definitely. Yeah. This leads me to esport, because that would be one of the. I mean, what we see now during the pandemic is a huge uptake in esports betting, because everything else was closed. And when I speak to people, it seems that we have this COVID pattern. People stay. Yeah. They go back to sport, they bet on football, but they kind of found how fun and interesting it was. So the number of players and the volume is still higher now than it was before. But this is a perfect. I mean, esports is stream sport, and you can put the odds on the players while they're sitting there, live odds, and so absolutely, I think this is also a future for the esport. This. Not struggling, but yeah, in a sense, they're struggling to find the big revenue streams. This could be a revenue stream.
Yeah.
When it comes to that, so you are streaming the game, whatever you're playing, and you have the teams they're playing each other, and you can set odds in between. You can do live odd setting, and depending on how the game is developing.
Yeah, and that's also now if we are now anyway doing business development for Dazn. I mean, let's do a little bit more. this is a great idea for Dazn to like create an esports arm within the streaming platform, right?
Yeah, they should. They should.
You know, right now you stream on Twitch. That's the kind of the platform where you see it. But there isn't any like mainstream, let's say, streaming platform which is offering esports streaming. So that's a next step as well, perhaps.
It is, and then on top of that, they could add some betting on that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I agree. What a lovely way. Now we are way over time today. But when you start, it's just so difficult to get out of it. Yeah. And it's super interesting to talk about. We planned this podcast a little bit before here today. And looking at the points that we wrote up, we didn't manage to go through that many. But and that's how it is when you have a good conversation, I think. But to end things today, Jesper, every time I speak to you, there is a different painting behind you, and the paintings are always so interesting. They always have something very strange in them. And I have noticed that today as well. There is a painting behind you that has something very out of the ordinary on it. So can you just explain what this painting today is all about?
I have to do like this. Yes. So it's a Greek German artist, and this is one of the best paintings we have. It's it's so strong, it's so good, and it has this combination of people. You can see there's they're all panicking except the old guy, and for me, getting older and older and being among the oldest these days, when I speak to people, that's a bit reassuring. And they're all panicking, and they're all seeing a threat, but everyone is seeing a threat from another direction than the other. So, and you don't really know why. And it's so full of interpretation, and it's extremely well done. I love that painting. Mm. And next to that painting, there's, perhaps you can't see it in this light, but there's let's see, my head gonna go this way. There's actually a bunch of black bananas.
Okay.
It's a Swedish artist named Johan Fernerström, who is specializing but he's doing a lot of really cool art, and some of those include bananas. Mm. So then the room is full, but we shouldn't spend more time on that one. We have to do another podcast next time, and
exactly.
I know it's about to sit.
Yes, let's continue the tradition every time there is
exactly.
A new thing.
That's a good idea. I'm gonna do that. Yeah.
I like it. So to finish off today, Jesper, last thing that I want to mention today is that you are launching, or we are doing a new podcast. Here, you are launching your own podcast.
Yes, so I'm going to sit on the other side of the microphone. I'm going to sit where you sit here, and trying to see how difficult it is to sit there and chat and discuss. Yes, it's going to be super interesting. And I am right now finalizing my first guest. I should wait a bit more before we have totally finalized it. But yeah, there's going to be hopefully some interesting discussions and some interesting people there.
Absolutely. I'm really excited to check that out. That is for sure, Jesper. I mean, you're one of the giants of the industry, Jesper. I mean, you've been here in this industry for, what's it, like close to 20 years. I mean, it's always super exciting to talk to you in general, and absolute pleasure. I can tell you that it's the easiest thing in the world to do this today and just have a nice conversation. So. Thank you so much, Jesper, and I'm looking forward to your podcast.
Thank you. I have so fun doing this. I mean, it's not even, we don't have to have a podcast. We can just sit and chat about this thing because it's so interesting. And I'm not one of the giants, but I've been here for some time. I spent some time thinking about it and discussing it with people. So hopefully something comes back and so forth.
And with those comments, I thank you all for today. Thank you, Jesper, and have a good rest of the day.
Thank you. Good.
This fruitful discussion has been brought to you by our sponsors, Pragmatic Solutions, leaders in intelligent platform technology. Is your business struggling to keep up with the development demands on your current gaming platform? Well, then it's time to upgrade to the Pragmatic Solutions PAM platform. Multi-tenant, multi-currency, multi-regional, API-based, rule engine automated, regulation ready, it's all here out of the box. Smart businesses leverage Pragmatic SaaS model and license powerful modern technology for a fraction of the cost of in-house development. Upgrade your business to the Pragmatic Solutions PAM platform. Visit www.pragmatic.solutions to arrange a platform demo. Stay safe and take care.